Ron Van Dam is nothing more than a figment of your imagination. Your dark, twisted, apparently very, very grumpy imagination. You should probably get some help. You're listening to The Ron Van Dam Show on New England Broadcasting.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night. It's the Ron Van Dam Show.
Whatever.
Hold on tight. Things can get a bit weird if you like that sort of thing.
Hey, welcome to the program. It is indeed the Ron Van Dam Show, as the announcer stated at the beginning of the project. I'll be with you for the next half hour. After that, you're on your own. And believe me, that's going to be fantastic. For the next 30 minutes, I will entertain you like an organ grinder's monkey, grinding my way into your heart. Hey, raise your hand if you've just been indicted. Oh, Don, whoa, look at your hand go up. Yeah, all right. I should mention that alcoholic consumption during this program only enhances the pleasure of the experience. That's all I'm saying. Went to a Mexican restaurant last night. They had a really nice bar, and I had a few margaritas, which I usually don't have because sugar drinks make me throw up. That tequila stuff, man, that like puts you away. I mean, I said to the bartender, what are you trying to have your way with me? And he said, no. All right, that's enough. That'll be enough. Thank you. Thank you very much. Please hold your applause to the end of the program. It screws me up when you applaud so loudly so early in the show. I don't know where to go from here. But thank you for your adulation. Can you spell adulation? I don't think so. Quick, how many times last night did you get up to pee? Huh? How many? Six? Oh, see a doctor. That's too many. That's too many. Way too many. Okay, this is indeed the Friday edition of the program. It should last you through the weekend, and I would be back again on Monday, theoretically. I have a very interesting guest coming up not too long from now. He has written a book. You know, you think that the elections here are just like off the charts here, all these conspiracies that were going on behind the election. I don't know. I don't know. Apparently, elections have been very interesting in the past as well, and this guy's an expert in that. And back in history, not that far back in modern days, around the Nixon time especially, I mean, people did some really weird things to stay in power. So this is not specific to, well, this is like extreme right now, but you know, it's happened almost all the time. So we're going to speak to him. I will find that interesting, and hopefully you will hold my hand and find it interesting as well. Not the hold-handing or the hand-holding or the hold-handing, but the actual book itself. So we'll do that soon. I do, you know, I have a studio. I'm in the studio right now. Duh. And I don't have real plants in the studio because there's no extreme sunlight here because it's a studio. And I don't have house plants because they would die. They would die if they heard me do the show every day, simply from that. But they're, you know, they'll get water. I will hydrate them, sure, but there's no sunlight. And I think plants like that kind of thing. I don't know. I didn't do a survey or a poll, but I believe they like sunlight. So in my studio here, I have all fake plants. They're not real. They are plants disguising themselves as plants, but they're fake. The leaves, they look like they're so real, but they're not. Very similar to my friendships. I don't have to water these fake plants. By the way, they're called artificial plants, artificial intelligence plants. They're not real. They're artificial. They are not real. They look real until you touch them. And then you realize, hey, these plants aren't real. I don't know if you can feng shui these things and get away with it. I don't think so. But I do have nature in my studio, but it's not real nature. So I have gone the artificial route. As far as it's embarrassing, but it's true. Why am I telling you this? Because artificial is just so much easier. Do you ever have sex with a real person? Oh, it's so involved. It's so much work and so much consideration and all. Yeah, it's pleasurable, but it's just so much work. Blow-up dolls? I've never done them, but it seems quite easy. Although, you got to blow them up and all that. Get an air pump. That's all I'm saying. Get an air pump. But anyway, thank you. Why am I talking about this? Because I want to avoid the elephant in the room. I do have an elephant in the room right now. His name is Betsy. And the elephant is quite cute. And it's artificial. Everything in this room is artificial, including my boobs. I mean, it's unbelievable, but true. I want to avoid the elephant in the room. That's an expression. I don't want to talk about that Trump thing, although this is going to, for the next months, for the next 6-7 months, we'll be talking about this thing. I will try not to get into it too much because it's going to become, at a point, like too much to handle, as everything that this guy is involved with is always too much. Everything this guy touches is too much to handle. I played a clip on the show yesterday, which I love the clip. I love when Trump says stuff because it's just so cool. It's just so, how can I put it? It's so cool. He's just everything he says is just so stupid that it's just fun to play and listen to. One of the best ones is one he did a couple of days ago, and he did it again yesterday. He just loves this, and I love him doing it too. Don, take it away.
Essentially, I'm being indicted for you.
And as I said yesterday, Don, thank you. I appreciate it. I've wanted you to be indicted for like 2.5 years now, at least. And now you're doing it for me. Oh, thank you, Don. Man, you know, I had given up on you totally. But then you actually are acknowledging that you're getting indicted for me. Look, Let's take it a step further, Don. I mean, as long as you're being so kind, how about this? How about you actually get convicted for me? That would be great, artificial Jesus. That would be great. Don, who do you think you are? Oh, my God. But, Don, thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, Don. He's being indicted for me. For me. Thank you, Don. You're fantastic, baby. You're fantastic. Thank you for being indicted for me. Thank you. Thank you. Because you've done nothing for me except ruin my life and ruin this country. So the least you can do is get indicted for me. Let's get convicted for me too. And then we can just stop this foolishness and get on with our lives. Thank you for trying to change the entire country, the Constitution, the legal system. Everybody is an idiot except for you. I know. I've met people like you before. It's a condition. It's a problem. But you can't be helped. You can't be rehabilitated. They can't bring you to jail and try to rehabilitate you because it's just not going to happen. You know that. So thank you for doing this indictment thing. I really do appreciate that. For once, you're considering other people, and I like that. Thank you. All right. My guest is going to join us momentarily, and we're going to talk about if stuff like this has happened in previous years in our modern history. Let's find out about that. You know, one of the reasons that I could never be president, and there's so many of them, besides the fact I don't want to be, is when your presidency is over, you have to set up a presidential library. And I don't know how to do that. I just don't. I don't have that many books. I've got one book that I know of. It's The Life and Times of Soupy Sales. But I don't know if that's what they're talking about when they're saying a presidential library. I got almost all of the National Geographics except for 20. That would be good. That'd be cool in my presidential library. But then you gotta give out library cards and people don't bring it back, don't rewind the tapes. Oh, that's Blockbuster. Sorry, that went out of business a long time ago. But, you know, they don't return the books. And so I don't want to set up a library. What a pain in the ass that would be. And after being president, you know, going through all that stuff, trying to save the planet and all that, to set up a library just seems counterproductive. So I don't want to do that. The Dewey Decimal System, do they still have that? Dewey, what's up with that? Why don't you just list things alphabetically? Why do we need numbers with decimals? Library books, it's not a mathematics course. What the hell was that? All right. My guest is going to join us momentarily, but first we have a commercial word. So you listen to this, and then I'll be happy.
Looking for someplace new and fun to take the family for breakfast? Then it's time to try Greg's House of Avocado Toast. Featuring all your breakfast favorites. White toast, wheat toast, rye toast, yes, even multigrain toast, and more, all topped with creamy avocado. Or mix it up a little with a toasted English muffin topped with avocado. Come in every Thursday for our chef's special creation, sourdough toast with avocado. If it's toast with avocado on top, you'll find it, and nothing else, at Greg's House of Avocado Toast.
Luke A. Nichter joins us now. He is an author and so much more. He's considered an expert in so many fields, has appeared all over the place accordingly, radio, television. He's authored quite a few books. Probably you wrote the entire library, I think, there, Luke.
All right. Okay. Well, there's still more work to do, but I guess. I'd love to talk about it.
I guess you've kind of covered every facet, the print media, the whole bit. Anyway, you know, as we sit here today, talk about elections and the amazing things that have happened within the past few of them. With one coming up. But to many people, they don't understand that elections have been weird quite a few times in our history. Is that right?
You know, there have. And you know, my interest in 1968 is you know, it's one of those elections, maybe the most divisive in modern U.S. history. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really something about that era, I think, most closely resembles our own. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is an example where, you know, I don't know that history repeats, But, you know, where we look to examples from history, whether it's to maintain our sanity, you know, find our way out of our current era, but these examples in history are instructive.
They are. You always learn by the past, and then you're surprised by what the future could be of even more consequence. The 60 election was quite interesting. And I guess elections behind the scenes are always quite interesting, but they're not always as uncovered as many of them have become. Now, this was an election between Johnson, Mondale, and a third party as well. George Wallace, I believe, was involved in that. Is that correct?
Yeah, you've got that right. Yeah, mm-hmm. You know, to sort of set the scene, you know, the book is really about the four major sides of the election, kind mm-hmm. of simultaneously. So you have outgoing President Lyndon Johnson, mm-hmm. who decides not to run, but still yet wants to influence the choice of his successor. Mm-hmm. The Democratic nominee is his vice president, Hubert Humphrey. Mm-hmm. The Republican nominee is former Vice President Richard Nixon. Mm-hmm. And then you have this unusual third-party challenger, former and future Governor of Alabama, George Wallace, mm-hmm. who manages to get on the ballot in all 50 states, and one of these third-party challenges that has the potential to really make a difference in the outcome.
Yes. Just to very quickly touch on what you just said, third-party candidates have always been a matter of contention as to whether that enhances or spoils. Where do you stand on that with the history?
Oh, well, you know, it's a matter of perspective. You know, if the third party represents your side, of course.
Well, yeah.
You know, that's a good thing. And if it spoils your side, of course, we look down on it. Mm. You know, one way to look at it today is I look at it. You know, there are very few issues on Capitol Hill today, I think, that probably would unite both major parties.
Right.
Maybe concern over China, dislike of social media companies, and I would say probably dislike of third party challengers.
Mm.
You know, if you want to make political enemies, declare your third-party candidacy and try to get on the ballot in all 50 states. It's really remarkable, you know, that Wallace was able to do this.
Yeah.
You know, one of the only times in U.S. history when you know, this such a thing could be pulled off.
Yeah, I guess Perot is the only other one I can think of recent years.
Well, and that's another great example, yeah. You know, in our recent past, in yeah. terms of another one that made a difference, mm-hmm. Maybe Sanders in 16,
yeah,
you know,
true.
Maybe in 2024, mm-hmm. there are some possibles mm-hmm. that might make it. But, you know, it's really, you know, maybe once in a generation that this happens, at least to an extent where it can make a difference.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Nixon, because he is still famous for being a little bit shady. Whether that's the case or not, I don't know, probably is. What kind of dealings were going on behind the scenes in that election?
Well, I don't presume to have the final word.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what I do basically is when I write a book, I talk to everybody I can.
Mm-hmm.
I do deep digging in archives, and I try to follow the evidence wherever it goes. And this book ended up in a place I did not plan for it to go. It was a meeting that I had with former Vice President Walter Mondale in Minneapolis in late 2017, who was absolutely emphatic that Johnson did not want his Vice President Humphrey to win, mm-hmm. and challenged me to look into that. I thought, how do I do that?
Mm-hmm.
And then it was, you know, the second thing I do when I write a book is you know, you talk to archivists at all kinds of archives. What's new, what's been donated, what could be coming up soon, what's going to be open. And sometimes they tell you, sometimes they don't. In this case, it was an archivist at Wheaton College outside of Chicago told me they plan to open the first portion of Reverend Billy Graham's diaries, or as he called it, his VIP notebooks.
Mm-hmm.
He had died in 2018 at age 99 and left behind these 50-some volumes documenting contact with presidents, beginning with Harry Truman in 1950 and going all the way to Barack Obama in 2014, as well as contact with 50 foreign heads of state. And I was told one other researcher had seen it for research on the British royal family, but otherwise I was the very first,
mm-hmm.
and was permitted to by the Grahams to publish what's in this book. So this is the first. And I think what it shows is that kind of the bottom line is it shows really the evolution of Lyndon Johnson in that year. first announcing he was not going to run. Then he wanted Nelson Rockefeller to run and to succeed him, because he thought only the brand name, the money, the good looks of a Rockefeller could beat a Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy. But then when Bobby Kennedy was assassinated in June, effectively giving the nomination to Humphrey and shifting the race to domestic issues, it shows that Johnson gradually shifted into the Nixon column. In particular, Nixon made a multi-point promise, which was a message carried by Graham to LBJ, not to criticize him, not to, to give him credit for Vietnam, to consult with him in retirement, and to do everything he could to give him a good place in history. And I think that's what LBJ really needed to hear at a time when many in his own political party were critical of both Vietnam and his great society.
Did you find that there was anything that was not above board about all of that, or was it within the confines of doing research and making your candidate as viable as possible?
Well, and I should say, you know, at the outset, I suppose, you know, when I pick up a new history book, I kind of figure out, try to figure what's the author's angle? You know, what's their, what are they really trying to push here? And this is a book that, you know, I really don't take a political side. I take a something for everyone approach. You know, I try to present the four major sides, Johnson, Humphrey, Nixon, and Wallace, in a way that I think the families and former staffers that I talk to, you know, would recognize. You know, this is the beginning of our understanding of Graham and presidents. As more 70 years of his personal papers are opened up, it's going to spawn all kinds of books. So this is really just the tip of the iceberg. I think it's interesting, and this is the way I'd answer your question, that Graham always said he was not a political advisor. He even in his own diary writes that he never passed along things that presidents told him, and he never did political chores for anyone. But the diary shows that obviously there were times he made exceptions to that practice, because I think most readers would look at this and show that he was deeply involved in politics, and in some cases, you know, was asked specifically to do things that were political, get members of Congress to change votes, get this delegate to a convention to talk to this person. I think it's clear that we think of Graham, you think of maybe religious history or evangelical history, but these records that are now being opened, this is just the beginning, are really about presidential history. And I think we're going to come to see the presidency from Truman to Obama in different ways.
It's interesting that politicians of that and popular people who get involved with politicians of that caliber have diaries. It's almost like it's almost like evidence. I mean, like, why would one do that unless they thought there was nothing wrong with what they were doing?
It's a great question. And Graham is not, I would say, a doctrinaire diarist. This isn't sort of writing every day. He'll catch it up. Some of it's dictated, some of it's written, and his handwriting is worse than mine. But I think what I find most fascinating about it is that it provides a unique window in what some have called the President's Club. You know, this idea that despite public political differences, those who have held what's been called the loneliest job in the world, you know, come to realize that in private they very much need each other. And that only when you've been a president can you appreciate others who served in that role. And Graham had access to that world. And he didn't write it all down for history. As a historian, I'm sure glad he wrote down some of it. But it's a rare look into a window that we don't typically, to a world that we don't typically see.
Yeah. Unless we're typically seeing it now, but don't know it yet. I mean, the question is always like, why would anybody want to be president when, as you're trying to do something, people are trying to take you down hard? It's like, wow, how can I even do my job if people are trying to destroy me all the time?
Well, I think it's also sort of a lesson of history itself that, you know, here it's 2023. We're talking about 1968.
Yeah.
That it can take a very long time. I mean, historians kind of sit down, and it's like they put together a puzzle, and you get all the evidence you can, all the puzzle pieces. You never quite know what the puzzle's supposed to look like in advance. You know, there's no image on the box to kind of study if you want to cheat a little bit. And you never find all the evidence, and you just do the best job you can. And so it's also a lesson that when you look at our crazy divided politics today, if we're talking about 68, 55 years later, it could take that long to make sense of our time period today.
Mm. Was that a political atmosphere that is as divided as it is today, or is this division that we are experiencing now unlike anything else?
You know, that's a great question, one I think a lot about. I would say, there are similarities. Mm-hmm. We're not quite there, I don't think. And kind of here's my analogy.
Oh.
You know, I think presidents are used to governing during times of crisis, and it seems like all govern during at least one, political, economic, mm-hmm. social, or cultural, military or foreign policy. You know, I would argue that the sort of Johnson-Nixon era checked all those boxes, and so does the Trump-Biden era, you know, if I can use that term.
Yeah.
You know, Nixon's longtime speechwriter, Ray Price, who's gone now, you know, once told me that if the 1860s were an actual civil war, the 1960s were a proxy civil war.
Mm-hmm.
And I think more and more people say something similar about America today. I would say we're not there yet when you look at sort of assassinations back then. When you look at the role of the draft, which was both a domestic issue because it caused unrest in the country and on campuses, but also a foreign policy issue with the Vietnam War. So we're not there yet, but in 55 years, we may look back on this period today and say it was more divisive. So then we just don't have that hindsight or that perspective yet to make a fuller comparison.
Okay, wow. That's a lot. Very quickly, let's touch on Wallace again, because he was a very interesting individual, kind of outside the box. And you state that, as if I understand it correctly, that this campaign strategy that Wallace used and that position of third party set the stage for others in the past and not in the past, but in the future. I mean, that was a change in political strategy that has stuck.
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. Yeah, I think if George Wallace was anything, again, an independent won 10 million votes mm-hmm. on the ballot in all 50 states. What Wallace showed was kind of proof of concept that of a national anti-establishment, populist, mm-hmm. anti-elite, mm-hmm. you know, kind of a demagogue candidate
mm-hmm.
that I would argue all successful populists in both parties have
yeah.
taken a piece of since. Even Nixon's choice of Spiro Agnew on the ticket
yeah.
was kind of a way of taking the anti-elite, anti-establishment, and putting it inside, embedding it within a kind of an otherwise establishment campaign.
Yeah.
And certainly, you know, you draw a line from, say, Wallace to Trump. The message, the rhetoric, the kind of populist
yeah,
demagoguery,
the same
has a lot
thing.
Of similarities.
It's the elite anti-establishment. My God, it's exactly the same words. Okay. Your book is fascinating. Tell us about the book.
So the book, as I say, kind of a look at the four major sides.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, I don't really take sides. I mm-hmm. present each side kind of from its own perspective.
Right.
And my focus is really on two things. My focus is on why the American people voted the way they did, and two, kind of how LBJ, which most people had written off after he withdrew from the ballot on March 31st on live TV, how LBJ maneuvered throughout that year as he shifted from politics to his political legacy. And as I say, you know, there's a ton of new evidence in the book, but also, you know, it's kind of a reminder about history itself that it's never really over. We're constantly debating, mm-hmm. analyzing, interpreting,
mm-hmm.
which is important because it reminds us about how we got to where we are today. And this is a particular era, I think, that it provides a lot of insight into what you see today.
Well, continue what you're doing because it's fascinating and you're doing us all a big favor here. Appreciate it. Pick up the book. It's The Year That Broke Politics. The Year That Broke Politics. He's Luke Nichter, and Google him. You'll find him. Do you have a website, Luke?
LukeNichter.com. LukeNichter.com. You'll find plenty there.
All right. Well, thank you to my guest. It's been a pleasure. Look, here's the deal. I have no more time for you. And I know that you have no more time for me. So this might be a good time to just stop this foolishness for now. Here's what's going to happen. I'm going to end the show. I'll be playing the closing theme music, which lasts about 20, 23 seconds. And then you'll go about your life. I'll go about mine. And that was great. I mean, we had a relationship, one-sided, obviously, but still, there was no touching involved. This is kind of pleasurable for me, and I hope for you as well. I'll be back again on Monday with a brand new program, but until that time arrives, well, take care of yourselves, make it a good day, and all that stuff, and I wish you peace.